The Word of Mouth podcast from NHPR is made possible with support from you, our subscribers.
And by Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers.
I'm Virginia Prescott with a special edition of Word of Mouth from NHPR. Today, a conversation with Bill McKibben. The journalist, educator, and grassroots rabble-rouser has been sounding the environmental degradation alarm for decades. His 1989 book, The End of Nature, is considered the first book about climate change written for a general audience. Now he's got a dozen books and numerous articles on the sources, effects, and gloomy predictions of a warming climate behind him. And he just had to lighten up. He's out with a novel, a funny novel, with some quirky characters and homespun hijinks. Here he is summarizing the plot of Radio Free Vermont, A Fable of Resistance.
It's the story of a small band of Vermonters led by a septuagenarian former radio host who decide that perhaps they'd be better off if Vermont seceded from the Union, but really more the thing that worries them is the kind of bigness of the world.
That's Bill McKibben for our occasional In the Spotlight series at the Capital Center for the Arts in Concord, New Hampshire. He kicked off the drizzly December evening by reading from Radio Free Vermont.
A beer truck lumbered slowly off the Crown Point Bridge from New York and began the drive up Route 22 toward Burlington. It hadn't gone a mile before the driver came to an orange detour sign in the middle of the road and turned left on a dirt farm track. He drove about a mile more, past cows staring impassively at the sides of his truck with its pictures of two young women in bikinis reclining in a hot tub and hoovering Coors Light long necks with an ardor that suggested deep and full-bodied pleasure. Around a bend in the road, the truck driver found another detour sign and followed it for 2 miles till yet another sign guided him down a dirt road next to a creek lined with willows, a creek still flowing in that mild January. After about a mile of that, with the road turning into rut, he came upon a lady in a balaclava holding a stop sign. The driver braked, and as he did, two young men also in balaclavas appeared, one on either side of the truck. Each had a tire pressure gauge, and within seconds, air was hissing out of the front tires, and the truck slumped slightly forward. "Apologies," said the lady in the balaclava. "This will take a little while, I'm afraid. If you wanted to walk to the nearest house and call the police, that's fine, but it's about 4 miles. Or you could wait a little while, and then we'll fill your tires back up again. Anyway, we've made you a picnic." She put a paper sack on the seat beside him and started lifting things out. "BLT with bacon from Vermont Smoke and Cure. Here's a whole pint of Stratford Creamery maple walnut ice cream. And here's something special, a bottle of the new Long Trail Coffee Stout from Bridgewater Corners. You can only have one because we're serious about DUI in this state, but I think you'll find it filling. And we've got a gift pack of beers from 51 of Vermont's brewers to send home with you. Did you know we had more breweries per capita than any place on earth? I have no idea why they think we need Coors too." While she talked, the two young men were busy hauling down cartons of the Coors. They opened each, quickly twisted the caps, and then turned the whole box upside down to drain. When the bottles were empty, they loaded the cartons into the back of two pickups. The driver watched for a minute and then spoke. "Hey, lady," he said, "this is going to take forever. I've got 1,200 cartons of Coors in the truck. Why don't you just toss them over the side and let me go?" The woman looked up at him from above a draining carton of beer. "Oh, sweetie," she said, "this is Vermont. We recycle." So they get this little rebellion underway, and the feds and everybody are kind of chasing them down and things. And so they can't, Vern, the septuagenarian leader of this band, is they're sort of holed up in a little farmhouse on the edge of the woods, and he can't go very far, but he does go out for a walk one day. And I thought maybe I'd read this just because I was driving over. It sort of seemed to fit the weather a little bit. Vern was wandering. He'd spent enough time in the world's great landscapes to know this wasn't one of them. There weren't but a few acres of old-growth trees left in Vermont, and even they weren't especially grand. A few giant white pines, but nothing like a redwood. There were no seas of jagged granite peaks, no Class 5 whitewater cataracts. When the Audubon Society made calendars every year, 11 of the 12 pictures came from out west, with alpenglow and buck elk and wildflower meadows. Vermont, or New Hampshire, supplied the picture for October, and it was usually a close-up of a yellow maple leaf spinning in an eddy on some tiny stream. Still, he thought, he wouldn't trade. Not New England for Montana, not Big Sky for the filtered glimpses of blue and white through the treetops, not hardwood for high granite. For one thing, when that yellow came and the red and the orange with it, the colors kept you nearly giddy. And when it was over, it was even better. The leaves were down by mid-October, and you could see the shape of the land again, see the late sun silhouetting the trees along the ridgetops as it set. You could sense the architecture of the hills, every hollow and creek run and knoll visible from the road. When people thought of trees, they thought of leaves. That's how a child would draw them. But the natural inclination of trees at this latitude was bareness. 7 months of the year, at least upslope, they stood there stoic. Leaves were the fever dream exception to the barren rule, and Vern felt calmer once they were down. He hiked on, watching for the open seeps and what should have been an icy wood. Out west, when you walked, you looked up. The mountains were mostly open. You could see for miles, hundreds of miles. But Vermont was closed in now that the sheep were gone, more than four-fifths forest. You couldn't normally see 100 feet in any direction, and so you tended to look down. And so the glories were minor key, the splay of turkey tail fungus on a down stump, the root of a birch arched high across a rock, a healthy pile of moose droppings just smaller than ping pong balls. Vern contemplated that last for a moment. You didn't see moose very often. You didn't see much wildlife because the woods were dense and it was easy for anything shy to disappear. He'd seen more deer in an afternoon at his sister's house in suburban Connecticut than in a season of sitting in his deer stand, rifle on his knees. He remembered a trip to Yellowstone when the kids were young, and how odd it seemed to be able to stand on a ridge and watch bears and elk and bison wandering by below in full view. He felt a little embarrassed for them. It seemed much more natural just to come across traces, scat or a buck rub on the soft bark of a cedar or the claw marks of a bear after beech nuts. He didn't need to see the animal itself any more than he needed to see his neighbors in their houses when he drove down the road. The thin line of smoke coming up from the chimney was assurance enough. But knowing that moose had returned to Vermont in his lifetime pleased him enormously. It was the idea that things repaired themselves, that if you backed off a little, didn't ask too much of the world, then it would meet you halfway. This was one of the few corners of the planet that had gotten better in the last century, he thought. Greener, healthier. The damage that too many sheep had done was wearing off. Or maybe you didn't even need to think of it as damage. It had been good then when Vermont was full of farmers, and it was good now when Vermont was full of trees. Life ebbed and flowed, came, went. Goodness didn't demand the one-way arrow toward progress and more. It was, he thought, a blessing to have lived out his life in a place that spun slowly like that yellow leaf, an eddy in the American rapids, a place that was shrinking when most of the country was growing, growing, ever growing. But the too warm January breeze pulled Vern out of his contentment. He saw a sloppy pile of bear scat on the ground next to his foot, and he shook his head. Bears were not supposed to be out in the woods, not in January, not in Vermont. They should be in their dens. Vermont might be a place outside the world's rush, but the world's rush was doing it in. Winter was vanishing, for one thing. You couldn't just ignore the world. That was the problem, because now it pressed in on you without regard for borders. Most presidents in his lifetime you could forget for weeks at a time, but not this one with the endless twittering. Too much somewhere else became too much here, which was why he was a fugitive, he supposed. So he's holed up, at least for a while, in this farmhouse that one of his compatriots owns. She runs the Academy for New Vermonters. When people show up, they go there and learn how to drive in the mud and how to cut down things with a chainsaw and all the sort of things that skills people need at this latitude and might not have acquired in their former lives, you know. They go on for a month or two building this rebellion, mostly through sort of underground podcasts and things. And they're having a good time in their way, and they get on toward town meeting day, which is going to be the kind of culmination of all of this. And the fellow who's kind of leading it decides enough with the underground podcast. He has to do what he's done most of his life, which is have an actual radio call-in show for a little while. Now, this is hard because the police are tracking them down, so he's a kind of secret location, but they've worked it out, and so indeed Vermonters are calling in from around the state to ask questions. And I'll just read the very last one just because it makes a little point that I want to make before I stop here. This is Art from Essex Junction. I want to say I think this whole secession thing is so stupid. The U.S. is the greatest country on earth. If we were off by ourselves, we'd be crushed. We'd be Haiti with Holsteins. That's it, just stupid. Art, thanks for the call, said Vern. And it's the right note to end on, because I think you're wrong. I think we'd be more like Finland with fall colors. I think we've got plenty of brains and resources to do just fine on our own. But you may be right, and that's the point. I've sat behind a microphone and listened for decades as Americans learn to stop talking with each other and start shouting instead. No discussions, just socialist or fascist or feminazi or bigot or whatever. So here's what I want to say, and I think it's the one thing no one ever says anymore in our public life. I think you're wrong, but you may be right. And that really is a point that I wanted to make. When I was writing this, the publisher said they were going to call it a fable of resistance. And I was completely fine with them doing that because an advantage to writing a fable is that you get to append a moral. In this case, it's not we should all secede, although ask me again in the second Trump administration. Instead, it's that when confronted by small men doing big and stupid things, we need to resist with all the creativity and wit we can muster, and if we can do so without losing the civility that makes life enjoyable, then so much the better.
Author and climate change activist Bill McKibben reading from his first novel, Radio Free Vermont. When we come back, we'll get his update on U.S. and global policy on greenhouse gas emissions and where he thinks humor fits into combating climate change. I'm Virginia Prescott. My conversation with Bill McKibben continues on Word of Mouth right after the break. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today on Word of Mouth, I'm talking with Bill McKibben, one of the nation's best-known environmentalists. Over the past 30 years, McKibben's long-form reporting and books have advocated for aggressively fighting climate change through sustainable energy sources, policies, and personal habits. He's co-founder of 350.org, which organizes climate change activism in hundreds of countries. Despite the gravity of his life's work, McKibben is not without a sense of humor. Just before the break, we heard him read from his new novel, Radio Free Vermont. It's about a ragtag bunch of secessionists who reject conglomerate coffee shops, beer brands, and big ag, and who manage to stay just a few ski runs ahead of state and federal law enforcement. I spoke with Bill McKibben in front of a live audience in the Spotlight Cafe at the Capital Center for the Arts in Concord, New Hampshire, and wondered how much fun he had dreaming up this fable of resistance.
Well, this was, you know, this book I've been writing for the last 8 or 9 years and cackling at my own jokes all the way through it. I didn't actually think I was probably ever going to publish it. I was doing it mostly to amuse myself and mostly because I was really homesick out traveling the rest of the world, you know, and this was a good chance to think about home. But then this year came around and it seemed the wrong year to publish my usual depressing tome about the, you know, decline of the planet. Everybody's sad enough, it seems to me, already. It's as if we've had a kind of dose of reverse Prozac, and we're jittery and anxious and a little beneath the waves all the time. It struck me that if I thought it was funny, maybe others would. It does strike me that perhaps if you want people to say you're funny, it's a good idea to spend 25 years being really unfunny first. And then almost anything, I mean, it's as if a dog gets up and walks on its hind legs. You don't really criticize it for its gait, you know. You're impressed that it can do it at all, you know. So,
is comedy the last refuge of activism?
Well, it's probably an important part of activism. Much as I love the environmental movement and the other important movements, it's possible that sense of humor is not the very first thing that one thinks of when one thinks of environmentalists. And it's possible that we should do a little more of that. We're good at the part of the brain that reacts to bar graphs and pie charts and things, which is an important part of the brain, but it's not the only part of the brain. And that's why at 350, we've always tried to make art and music and humor at least a little bit of what we do.
In the book, there are so many things for example, the limousines that they travel in at the courtroom that comes into the scene is a Subaru with tinted windows. There are a lot of digs on, you know, overarmed local police departments. There is a climactic chase scene where our septuagenarian has to stop and breathe every now and again.
It is, I think, the only, in American literature, the only cross-country ski chase scene. I'm pretty sure that Norwegian literature features, you know, many manifold instances of this, but...
So this is kind of the anti-thriller on some level. But as you know, there's an eyeball-rolling element to the sanctimony of a lot of activists. This is something that we sense. So, you know, how to get it right? And how did you in this book?
Oh, I don't know if I did, but activism at its best involves always expanding the group of people who can be part of this. The point of it is to get more and more people engaged, and that means not talking to yourselves, not always speaking in the language that's congenial to other activists, but figuring out how to speak in ways that bring lots of people in. Climate change is the perfect example. This is, they don't call it global warming for nothing. I mean, this is the first problem that the entire world has to somehow figure out how to deal with. I mean, we started trying to figure out how to do that by when we decided to call this thing we were doing 350.org, partly because it's the most important number in the world, the amount of carbon in parts per million that you could safely have in the atmosphere, a number we're well north of now, but also because we knew that if we were going to work all over the world, it wouldn't do to just pick some English word that didn't mean anything to anybody. 350 means the same thing in, you know, New Guinea and New Hampshire.
Well, now that we know that this book set in a warm and muddy January, another 2016 record rise in the amount of carbon in atmosphere, 3 parts per million rise. Now, your organization, as you mentioned, 350.org, wants to get it down to 350. And your website says, we can fix this. Can we?
Well, we're not it's not possible to stop global warming. One has to be realistic about it. The name of the book that I wrote 30 years ago about all this had the cheerful title, The End of Nature. So, you know, a Pollyanna, I'm not. On the other hand, it's been pretty remarkable to watch over the last 6 or 7 years as some of the clear answers have finally emerged. You know, even 10 or 15 years ago, we knew we had to get off fossil fuel, but it wasn't clear what could take their place. The price of a solar panel has dropped 90% in the last 10 years. That suddenly opens up a realm, a whole world of possibility. The price of, I mean, wind and sun now in much of the world generate the cheapest electricity you can find. And so we see at least the possibility, if we chose to make use of these tools. The places that have actually done it are, you know, big enough to give us some sense of the possibilities. I mean, look at Denmark, okay? They generated half their power from wind last year, which either means that the wily Danes have figured out a way to corner the world's wind supply, you know, or it means they're taking the same tools that all the rest of us have access to and have the political will to put them to use. If they can generate that much power from the wind in Denmark, you can generate that much power offshore in New Hampshire. I mean, it's not, you know, it's just the other side of the same ocean.
You're listening to the journalist, author, and activist Bill McKibben, recorded live in the spotlight. You use the term global warming.
Mm.
And I was reading a report from NPR, actually. They went through a number of National Science Foundation grants from last year, 2017, and noticed a sharp reduction in the term climate change in either titles or subjects and summaries of those reports. Of course, responding to an administration that's been openly hostile to using climate change as a term. So what's the importance of this terminology?
Well, let's talk about the administration for just a sec. I mean, I don't think the terminology is all that important. So you can tell by my gray hair, I'm old enough at this that I remember when we talked about the greenhouse effect, okay? But the administration shut down the federal panel that was helping cities deal with extreme weather events. As the head of it said, we were almost the last place in the federal government where we were talking about climate change publicly. And the irony of that, on the same day that an utterly out-of-control firestorm drove tens of thousands of people out of their homes in Ventura, you know, after a fall when we've seen storm after storm after storm cripple city after city after city. I mean, it doesn't actually deter physics if you don't talk about it. It still happens anyway, you know.
Last month, the global climate meeting in Bonn, this was the follow-up to the Paris Accords. What happened, what didn't in Bonn?
Well, so it was a very interesting meeting. First thing to be said is, it's utterly shameful that the U.S. pulled out of the Paris Climate Accords. We've put more carbon in the atmosphere than any other country over the history of the last century. The good news, to the extent there was out of the Bonn climate meeting, was that the rest of the world seems not to be necessarily following in lockstep. I was worried that this would give other countries permission to go back on their pledges, and if U.S. isn't going to do it, why should we? But for the most part, people are sticking with what they said they would do, and in some cases, even exceeding to some degree.
But the industrialized countries, are they anywhere close to meeting the targets?
No. Some countries will. I mean, if all the world was Scandinavia, we'd be fine. But no, most people are not going to meet their targets, and even if they did, it wouldn't be enough. If you want to understand one thing about climate change, it's that we need to go fast. Unlike other political problems, I mean, if the president succeeds in getting rid of Obamacare, that'll be, in my opinion, bad, and lots of people will suffer, and there'll be lots of pain and debt and bankruptcy and so on. But 4 years from now, it won't make it remarkably harder to address the problem. Someone will still be able at some point to go in and propose that we treat this problem the way that every other country on Earth does, and you know, eventually we'll do it. Climate change isn't like that. It's the one problem with a fixed time limit, and if we don't solve it soon, we will not solve it, because we'll pass these physical tipping points. The Arctic will melt. The Arctic is melting. So the need for speed makes it a different kind of problem, and if I get depressed on occasion, that's the reason. Look, 75 years from now, this planet's going to be powered by sun and wind. The question is, will it be a broken planet that's powered by wind and sun? And if we don't make that change very quickly, then it will be a broken planet.
What is to prevent energy companies from taking over that sphere as well as the fossil fuel sphere, you know, using their infrastructure, using their power grids?
Well, so this is the great question, you know, and this is what should have happened. We know now from great reporting from the LA Times, the Columbia Journalism School, others, that companies like Exxon knew everything there was to know about climate change 30 years ago. They had it completely nailed. Their product was carbon. They had great scientists. They studied it hard. They figured it out. They even started taking actions. You know, they built all their drilling rigs so they'd accommodate the sea level rise they knew was coming. All they didn't do was tell the rest of us. Instead, they spent gazillion of dollars building this kind of architecture of denial and deceit and disinformation that kept this completely phony debate going for 25 years. Why didn't they decide that they were going to own the solar industry, which they could have done? I mean, Exxon had enough cash flow to, you know, I think the reason is that while you can make money doing this, you can't make as much money as you can doing oil and gas. And the reason's simple. Once you've paid to have the solar panel up on the roof, the sun comes for free. And from Exxon's point of view, that's a ridiculous business model, you know? It's so much better if you have to write them a check every month for the rest of your life, you know? So we didn't get there, and I don't think at this point that, you know, those companies are nimble enough to ever catch up. Instead, they're spending their money making sure that we slow down this transition, that they prolong for another 10, 15, 20 years their business model, even at the cost of breaking the planet. The good news is that other entrepreneurs are figuring out how to do this and all over the world. I was in Africa this spring for The New Yorker. And it was quite wonderful to watch in village after village that were way off the grid and were never going to get electricity, I mean, in any reasonable time frame ever. I mean, there's still a billion people without electricity on the planet. Solar panels had gotten cheap enough that people were now installing them left and right, village by village. I was in one Ghanaian village near the equator, so it was hot, 95 degrees all the time, and sitting there with the elders talking about the solar microgrid they'd installed the week before, 40 solar panels enough to power, you know, the 75 huts or so in this village. And the guys kept handing me cold bottles of water, which I was grateful for, but I couldn't figure out, took me a little while in my clueless American way to figure out why they were so proud of this. It's because until the week before, there'd never been anything cold in that town at all. There'd never been a refrigerator. Cold was a new concept, okay? That really struck me. We take things like the solar panel, seem a little obvious, or take them a little bit for granted, but it's wizardry. I mean, you point a sheet of plate glass with a little inlaid silicon at the sun, and out the back comes cold and light and communications and, you know, that's Hogwarts-grade wizardry. I mean, that's really amazing if you think about it, and very, very hopeful.
Mm. Well, I think so many people wonder what they can do about all of this, about global warming, then it may feel very small to do acts of conservation on our own. It feels like there's so much mounting against it.
Mm.
And short of like donning balaclavas and holding up trucks or you know, even going to Puerto Rico and help setting up solar panels. I mean, what do we do?
Well, it's the right question. I think at this point, though it's very important that we do individual things in our homes. I mean, my house is covered with solar panels. I drove the first electric Ford in Vermont, you know, all these. I don't try to fool myself that that's how we're going to deal with climate change. At this point, given the short time that we have and the scale of the problem, you can't make the math work one household at a time. So the most important thing an individual can do, in some sense, is not be an individual quite so much. Join together with other people to build the movements that have some possibility of changing policy at fundamental levels that may allow us to catch up with the physics of climate change. That's why we started 350.org. I mean, your observation is correct. Climate change is very large. We seem very small against it. But it turns out that there are millions upon millions of people around the world ready to come together and take action. And if we do that, then we have a sporting chance anyway.
Bill McKibben, recorded live in the spotlight. We'll come back and talk more about his novel, Radio Free Vermont, after a short break. Plus, why he thinks environmentalism is essentially a conservative movement. That's when Word of Mouth continues with Bill McKibben. I'm Virginia Prescott, wrapping up my conversation with the writer, educator, and activist Bill McKibben. Decades after he introduced the concept of global warming to audiences outside of the scientific community, McKibben has published a novel called Radio Free Vermont. The book cover calls it a fable of resistance. And if there's a moral to this fable, call it Small is Beautiful. The book follows a clan of diehard Vermonters who spark a secessionist movement, almost by accident. There is, in real life, a fledgling but devoted secessionist movement in Vermont, with a commitment to reject what it calls the tyranny of corporate America and the U.S. government, and to restore Vermont's status as an independent republic. It's a movement where liberal and libertarian ideologies live side by side, not unlike New Hampshire and Vermont. Two states seemingly opposite, yin and yang. So I asked one of Vermont's premier citizens, certainly its most Twitter famous, his theory on why the two states are so different.
Think about the two mottos. New Hampshire's is, you know, much grabbier. I mean, live free or die. It's pretty good if a little, you know, melodramatic. Vermont's is freedom and unity. There's been a strong sense of community and community obligation for a very long time, and I'm not entirely sure where it came from. It's possible that Vermont's very early history, you remember that Vermont was not one of the 13 original colonies. It was an independent republic for 15 years before it joined the rest of y'all, that may have marked it in with a certain kind of that sort of need of small places to look in on themselves a little bit. I don't know.
Well, I've been thinking a lot about secession because of the book. It's such an interesting... Verne has trouble with it. I mean, he realizes
absolutely.
That, you know, there are a lot of reasons why we're in a union, and it made me think about, okay, secession from Vermont, I can imagine that, but what if it were Alabama?
If Alabama wanted to go off on its own, it would... It would not cause me a great heartache, I must say, on the...
It feels like there is, unfortunately, like so many things in our contemporary culture, a partisan divide. You know, there's a ultra-localism and secession. You know, they come in
absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, as I say, that one of the really important parts of this is figuring out how to talk with each other again. And partly that has to do with scale. So I try to imagine, I mean, I live in a small town. Our town meeting first Tuesday in March is about as big as this gathering here at the Capitol Center for the Arts. If someone like Donald Trump strode in talking the way that he talks on Twitter, say, it wouldn't work. People would look at him for a minute, kind of slack-jawed, and eventually someone would say, okay, it's time for someone else to talk now, you can sit down, and no one would pay him any attention the rest of the time. I think that small rural places have stayed a little bit behind the rest of the country in the sense that most places in America, neighbors have been for the last 50 years an optional thing. Mm. In our kind of high consumer culture, you really don't need your neighbors for anything practical. You have a credit card, some guy will deliver your groceries to your door, you know? What do you need anybody else for? But it obviously doesn't work quite like that the further out you get into the sticks. Vermont's the most rural state in the union, so we think about that a good deal. And I don't think it's going to work that way in the future. When Hurricane Irene hit in Vermont, we very quickly discovered that you darn sure needed your neighbors to you know, shovel the mud out of your basement, to bring you food if you didn't have, you know, on and on and on. And I don't think in the end that that's going to be the saddest discovery in the world. I know that there's, in New Hampshire especially, kind of strong libertarian strain. I don't find that in the end all that appealing. I think it's a kind of experiment that doesn't work that well because in the end, human beings are social primates.
There's a moment in the book when Vern, on his radio show before he went turned into a fugitive, where he realizes that people call him to talk just because they're lonesome.
Yeah.
There's the social erosion.
That's sort of what gets him going, this yeah. character, because he kind of realizes from listening to people every morning for year after year after year that some of that old community stuff, even in a place like Vermont, is breaking down mm-hmm. and that people do not feel the same kind of connection that once they did, that the institutions of that life, the church or the small town school or whatever, are disappearing. The local store in favor of the giant anonymous box on the edge of town, you know, or worse yet, the Amazon package that arrives in the, you know, someone said the other day, can I get Radio Free Vermont, you know, anywhere? I said, yeah, you can get it anywhere, but you really should buy it at your local bookstore if you can, because that's, or go to your library, because those are the kind of institutions that sustain places.
Well, nobody gets hurt during this revolution, though, though there are some shots fired. One of the characters is a former biathlete and a fantastic shot, a sniper in Iraq. Got a lot of respect from the local NRA chapter. But there are a lot of gun-loving liberals in this book. And I wonder, is Vermont the sort of place for breaking down?
Well, this was actually a really interesting, this became a kind of national issue because people, when Bernie was running yeah. for president, people were like, yeah, but you know, what's your thing on gun control? And, you know, he was sort of nonplussed by it a little bit because he spent most of his life in Vermont, where on the one hand, the gun laws are as lax as it's possible to be. In our state constitution, there's stronger, you know, privilege than the Second Amendment for gun ownership. And on the other hand, there's extraordinarily low levels of gun violence. So it never really did become the same kind of issue. And I got to say, I think his kind of instinctive answer actually made sense, that this is one of the things that it would do well to think about on a place-by-place basis, the idea that exactly the same logic makes sense everywhere in the country, in a country as diverse in experience and geography and circumstance as this one, seems unlikely.
What other sort of states' rights-guided issues do you think belong with the states?
Well, I think that one of the things that we need to get our minds around is the idea that this dichotomy between sort of liberal and conservative has broken down or at least been robbed of any sense of the words. There's very little that's conservative anymore about conservatism. I think of myself as a fairly conservative human being in many ways. I mean, I'm a Methodist Sunday school teacher. But I think of myself as a conservative most when I'm working on climate change. I mean, think about it for a minute. What we're asking for is to have a planet slightly like the one that all human beings until 20 years ago had ever known, mm-hmm. a planet where there was some ice at the top and the bottom, the odd coral reef left in between. You know, that's not a radical set of demands. That's a deeply conservative set of demands. And the idea that somehow conservatives in our polity have come to be people who say, change the chemical composition of the atmosphere all you want and just see what happens, that strikes me as profoundly radical.
You read a little bit about Vern's walk through the woods, and I think this is the scene where he feels grateful that he saw, you know, he knows the world in this way. And people in the future are not going to know the world in that same kind of way. So how to communicate that without being nostalgic for, oh, the way things used to be?
And one does I mean, one thinks about it in many ways. I get saddest because cross-country skiing is one of my, maybe my main vice in the world. I get really sad at the idea that winter is disappearing. Of course, it's much sadder other places. I was in the Pacific 18 months ago with our 350 crew in the Pacific, and I happened to be there when that wave of warm water sloshed around the planet, and in a course of 2 weeks in many places killed 50, 75, 80, 90, 100% of coral reefs that have been there for far longer than humans have been there. I remember talking to a biologist, a marine biologist who'd just come up from a dive. She said, I had to come up because I was crying inside my mask, and it was filling up with tears. My study site that I've been going to for 40 years, you know, which was teeming with life 2 weeks ago, is dead now. It's a boneyard. I don't know whether it's nostalgic exactly to worry about that, but there's something, there's whatever emotion one takes from it, one should let that emotion kind of guide one into doing something to keep it from getting any further down this road.
How do you keep from getting depressed?
Well, I don't always keep from getting depressed, as you can tell. But it's very helpful to be part of a big, broad movement. We think at 350.org that we've organized about 20,000 demonstrations in every country on Earth except North Korea. And we have pictures of most of them, because everybody's very good about taking pictures and putting them up on the Flickr account and things. So if I get really depressed, I'll go and look through those sometimes, and especially at the ones, and it's most of them, that are taking place in parts of the world where people did little or nothing to contribute to the problem that we face now. If people in those countries are willing to work with us and do what they can and participate, it strikes me that I should be able to get myself out of the dumps and go do the work that I need to do. So that's helpful to me a lot. Also, you know, good beer helps.
I'm Virginia Prescott with the author, environmentalist, and now novelist, Bill McKibben. Our conversation was recorded live in a spotlight at the Capital Center for the Arts in Concord, New Hampshire. That also reminded me of another question from the audience. Is it possible that Trump has jump-started the biggest environmental movement that this country has ever seen?
You know, if one's looking for, you know, maybe a little pie-eyed optimism, one thing that might be happening is that Trump, I think, on climate change especially, has kind of jumped the shark, as we say. The oil companies looked on and winced when he pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord, because it sort of screwed up their careful, decades-old strategy of just kind of slow-walking this problem forever and ever. They were willing to say by a couple of years ago, yes, this is a problem, and we can handle it. We must be very realistic and moderate and move very, very slowly. And that was pretty much working. Well, Trump obviously has caused huge problems by not doing any of that, but it's also at least possible that when he goes down, he'll take a lot of things with him, and one of them will be any sense that it's okay to be half-hearted about this climate stuff.
Well, you mentioned that now that the U.S. is shedding its role as a leader in the fight against climate change, another emerging leader would be China. Mm. And also Canada, the UN, certainly. So are delegates from other countries openly criticizing the U.S.?
Yes. Angela Merkel, that radical. German, you know, the day after Trump pulled out of Paris, you know, said, you know, no country of goodwill will follow down that path or something, which is about as strong a language as you get in, you know, diplomacy, at least diplomacy prior to Trump. But it's, you know, there are very few countries that are doing unambiguously good things. Look at Canada. They actually are taking good policies about their own you know, use their own emissions, but there are not that many Canadians, so that doesn't really matter very much. They're also busily trying to pump every last drop out of the tar sands of Alberta. That's far more important, and like most politicians, Prime Minister Trudeau has been completely unwilling to stand up to the fossil fuel industry. So it's, you know, it's hard every place.
A question from the audience. Mr. McKibben, I follow you on Twitter, and you sound a little bit cranky and harsh with good reason. But you are funny and soft-spoken. Can you or do you want to mix the two?
Well, I do try to mix it up. I'm always, on Twitter, people usually say that I'm a little arch, you know. I don't actually, I'm so tired of Twitter. My colleagues at 350 got me onto it early and told me to go over and tweet. And before, you know, eventually, I now have like a 250,000 Twitter followers. And someone did a thing. I had the most Twitter followers of anyone in Vermont. And I think because Bernie is registered in D.C. But
Sort of old new media world comes up in this book a fair bit. Their secessionist movement really takes off on social media.
Well, but it really takes off. I mean, what's really important about it is that it takes off on radio, on podcast.
Yes, so much talk about that.
And radio is some, it always amazes me that radio, no matter what other new technology comes along, the human voice seems to survive through this. The radio and now the podcast just keep moving steadily forward. It's not impossible to use the radio for fake news. You know, we've seen, you know, from Father Coughlin on, people who've managed to do it. But it's a little harder, I think.
You mentioned the call for all the creativity we can muster in terms of activism. So what does that mean for you?
Well, one of the things it means is a lot of engagement of music and art and humor. All the things that appeal to that other half of the brain. Because resistance is really important. It's probably our most important job right now, but we don't have a very good idea how to do it. As I can testify, having run some big campaigns, we're making it up as we go along all the time. And so we should try to do it as creatively as possible because we're still figuring out sort of what the tools might be. And, you know, some of it, we're seeing new stuff all the time. I mean, it was quite, to my mind, inspiring this year to see people figuring out how to make NFL playing fields a kind of site of resistance, you know, and with great effect. I mean, everybody was talking about it right away.
So I'm leaving this last question to a member of the audience. So if we do break the planet, after we are all long gone, will the planet be able to heal itself?
If you back up far enough, well, none of it really matters because in a billion years, the sun's going to explode and that'll be that for our happy planet anyway. But I find myself, for some reason, unable to back up that far, you know? I mean, I'm a child of the late Pleistocene. It seems worth a life's work to try and preserve some of the flora and the fauna that we came onto this planet with, and to preserve our own remarkable species. A couple years ago, when Shell Oil announced that it was going to go drill for oil in the Arctic, and it made me uniquely mad. I mean, like scientists had said, if you warm the planet, it will melt the Arctic. Indeed, it did. Shell didn't look at that and say, huh, maybe we should go into the solar panel business. This isn't working out so well. They looked at that and said, huh, now there's no ice up there. It'll be much easier to go drill. I mean, that's a pretty powerful reproach to the idea that the big brain was a good adaptation, okay? I mean, that's about as dumb as it gets. Happily, there were tons of people with perfectly good brains attached to really big hearts who took to the waters in Portland and Seattle where these giant drilling rigs were deploying to go up north. And in small craft, they kept circling them and harassing them and keeping them from moving out. We called these people kayaktivists. And By the end of the summer, Shell had suffered enough brand damage that they pulled the plug on the whole thing, said, we're not going to go drill in the Arctic after all, you know, which reminded me again that there really is something magnificent about our funny little species, and it would be a good idea to try and preserve ourselves as well going forward.
Please join me in thanking Bill McKibben.
Bill McKibben, author of The End of Nature, Earth, and other books, and now Radio Free Vermont. Our conversation was recorded live for In the Spotlight, a partnership between Gibson's Bookstore, the Capital Center for the Arts, and NHPR. Our thanks to Michael Herman, Elizabeth Jewell, and the staff of Gibson's Bookstore. NHPR's broadcast producer is Taylor Quimby. Live sound and recording engineer, Andrew Perella. Digital producer is Sarah Plord. Thanks also to Steve Martin, Viv Lewine, Lynn Sabian, Ben Blanchard, and Lauren Gregory at the Capital Center for the Arts. Music for this broadcast from Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks for listening to this special broadcast of Word of Mouth from NHPR.